my parents weren't musicians, but my mother did listen to the radio all the time, had the radio on, and she talked about when she was growing up listening to the Metropolitan Opera every Saturday. So she knew all the arias, she knew the plots of the operas, and shared that with me. My dad was a great whistler, a fantastic whistler. I remember one time asking him, how do you do that? And he said, how do you do what? And I said, you make your whistling like go up and down. And later on, I found out it was vibrato. And he said, I don't know, I just do it. But he was always listening to Sinatra and Tommy Dorsey and so on. So he had his instrument with him all the time.
Now, at one point, you heard him play the piano, which was a surprise.
It was years later. Yeah, I had been teaching, brought home the first Casio keyboard. And I said, you've got to check this out. And I had never seen him at a keyboard before. And he sat down and started playing melodies. I mean, all sorts of melodies. And I asked him, how do you do that? I didn't know you played. And he said, well, I never did, but I seem to have figured it out. So apparently there was a lot of musical ability that he had that was just never tapped.
Except for your enjoyment of his whistling all those
years. Oh, gosh, yes. Yes.
So let's go to fifth grade then. Mm-hmm. Tell us about a moment in time when you thought, this might be my life.
Yeah. It's funny because I really wanted to play the clarinet, and there weren't any more clarinets left, so it was trombone. And I came home, and I was crying, but I gave it a shot. And I had a wonderful teacher, Werner Lutz, who went to Potsdam Crane School. And I just watched him. He was tremendous. He would demonstrate. He would have us do it. He'd critique us and just encourage us. And I think watching him sort of made me decide that's what I'm going to do. I didn't think about it, you know, in the years that followed until I realized, you know, in high school, I said, I want to do what he did. And that's what I did.
And your parents encouraged you?
Yes, they did. They're very proud of me.
So let's fast forward then to your years at the Crane School and your experience being a music student there and an ethnomusicology class that you took there. What were you learning about?
Yes, it was interesting. Miss Atel was her name, a violinist who also taught the course. And, you know, it was basically what music, the relationship of music in people's cultures from all around the world, and found out that music was very basic to all sorts of rituals and rites and growing up and so on, you know, birth, death, entertainment, telling stories about their life and so on. So that's the journey I took, where even to this day now, I'm involved in playing in numerous groups. But in the last year or two, I've played wedding ceremonies for the ceremony, wedding receptions. I played a memorial service, sang a song at a memorial service for a very dear friend who passed away. So it's, you know, what that teacher was talking about as far as music at all sorts of ceremonies and our life's journey, I'm doing that now.
Well, music has spiritual power. I mean, there's a sort of mystical element. You can talk about theory and notes on the page, but the actual sound of music is a very powerful thing.
Yes, it is. It is very powerful. And I'm also playing, currently I'm playing with the Finger Lakes Symphony, and we just did Brahms 4th last year, and we're doing Respighi's Pines of Rome in a couple of weeks. And when you talk about spiritual power, there's something about that can just move you so much.
I love the end of that when the Roman legions come marching over the hill.
Yes.
Oh, so exciting.
The Appian Way, yes.
Who's your conductor?
Shade Sajak is a wonderful conductor. This is his first full year with the orchestra, but he is just tremendous. He really lets the orchestra do its thing.
Fantastic. Now, you taught for many years at Palmyra Macedon.
Yes.
Junior high band?
Yeah, elementary for the first 13 years and then finished off junior high, middle school. Yes.
Does it all seem like a blur? Do you remember certain years more than others?
Yeah, I do. I do. But, you know, and it's funny how the years seem all compressed, but, you know, there were so many years there. And, you know, it's funny, I'll run into students to this day. I was over at my hardware store, and I recognized the person behind the desk. "Mr. Hassler, how are you?" And I said, "Good, you were a drummer. I forget your name. I always forget the names. There were so many. But I said, you were a drummer, and you did this solo when you were in eighth grade." And, you know, it's great to see those students again. Yeah.
My father was a junior high band director for some 30 years in
yes.
the Albion School District.
Oh, yeah.
And he was about to retire about the time that I was finishing my own college years.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be a teacher. And this is a sidebar, obviously, but, you know, he sort of advised me not to go into it. At that time, he felt like teaching was becoming more difficult.
Yeah.
What are your feelings about it?
I know that I look back at the years I was teaching and call them the glory years, where we could just teach. Through the years, there were more mandates to do to work literacy into the program, and you know, we would do that certainly. And the last few years, I've seen what all the hoops that teachers have to go through, and hopefully, I think in some ways things are loosening up a bit. You know, some of the districts I've been in recently have not put as much emphasis on the test results, and they're letting people be happy, and the teachers seem happier, and therefore the students seem happier, and I think it's a good thing.
Well, you must have former students that have gone into teaching because of you.
Yes, I have had some, and some are in the area, and they're getting close to retirement as well. It's really funny. The years go by.
So what are some basic words of advice you would have for someone who is teaching music right now?
I'd say, first of all, you know, make sure that you're always performing, you're always playing and enjoying it and loving it and listening to music as well, all kinds. The second thing is just, you know, the best way you can encourage students is to show them, demonstrate, and then, you know, tell them what they're doing well and just have them enjoy it. I think those students who really want to pursue will, you know, and others who may not be on, you know, as motivated, you know, they should be part of the band as well, or orchestra or chorus. It's a social thing as well as a discipline thing.
Well, a few years ago, I saw you playing out with my friend Adam Wilcox, and I remember it was a Good Luck restaurant.
Yes.
You were sort of behind the keyboard player, and you picked up a trombone, and you put that down, and then you picked up a flute, and then you put that down, and then you picked up another instrument, and I kept thinking, what don't you play?
Right. Well, you'll never know what I don't play. But I've given fiddle a chance, but at this point, I don't have the dexterity. And oboe, forget it. Yeah, that takes a lot of pressure. But I think playing alongside all my students through the years, you know, got me some chops to do that. And playing in that band was a lot of fun. Gives me opportunities. I also sit in with the Rapiers, Watkins and the Rapiers, for December. And they were looking for someone to play some melodies here and there. So I do some trombone and saxophone and keyboard with them. It's given me the opportunity to write a song. I've got a second song I'm going to try and premiere this December. I also play guitar with some Irish groups and really enjoy that. So there are so many opportunities that I've had, you know, playing all these instruments that I'm invited to play with other people, and it's been wonderful.
Has your joy in music ever waned?
No. No, never. And I think part of it is playing with orchestras and bands and brass quintets and so on, that there's so much there to keep it going, you know. And I may let trombone go a little bit, you know, to put more energy into guitar, but it all comes around.
You ever get to play the clarinet?
Oh yeah, I love the clarinet. I really do. So that instrument I wanted to play in the beginning, I can finally play now.
Well, let's talk about playing for weddings. What are some things that you've observed as a wedding musician?
Well, you know, for the ceremonies, sometimes it's a song, an appropriate song, and sometimes it's more ceremonial music like the voluntaries and so on that you might play with the brass quintet. Receptions, I probably have played over 500 weddings with one band in particular. And it's fun because sometimes we've done another wedding for the same person. And I remember a bride coming up to us and saying, "Oh, yeah, I want you guys to play at my next wedding, and because you know exactly what to do, but just don't play the theme from Ice Castles again." I mean, that shows you how many years ago it was. But, you know, that was kind of fun, too, because you might play some quiet jazz during cocktail hour, and then later on, you know when it's time to bump it up a little bit, and when to get crazy, when to read your crowd and know when it's time for a ballad, a slow song, and then when to go into the funk and so on. So that was always fun to do, too, to sort of read the crowd and figure out what they want before they ask for it.
What do you look for? What signs are you looking
for?
You
can tell when, you can tell people get excited and they start moving, that they want something to dance to, some high energy song, whether it's big band or rock or so on. And then you can tell when they're getting tired, they're sort of looking at you like, okay, I think that's enough. Sometimes when the dance floor is empty, you play a ballad, get everyone up there, and then work the crowd that way.
Interesting.
Much like a DJ does, I'm sure.
Well, being emotionally attuned to the whole crowd is like psychology, really.
Yes, it really is. Yeah. I think it was from doing a lot of weddings, we got better at knowing what to do.
Let's talk about funerals. What's the challenge of playing for a funeral as opposed to a wedding?
The challenge there is that you want the music and you want the performance to support the people, but at the same time, you don't want this to bring people down. But you want it to reflect what the deceased, liked. I mean, a song that they liked or a certain mood that they liked. You also want to prepare enough to know that you can get past the grief as well. I recently performed the song, played guitar and sang Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. And it probably took me performing it by myself and then in front of a few friends, maybe 60, 70 times before I could actually get through it and know that I could hold it together. But at the same time, you want it to be everything you have, all the expression you have to make this appropriate for a memorial service.
Would you say you almost have to put up sort of a shield or a distance?
Yes, you do have to do that. Yeah, and I think that came with repeated practicing and a confidence that I can do this now and make it a performance more than...
I'm sorry about your friend.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it was very sad and unexpected. But
what is it about that song that you think resonates at funerals?
This was a song that her friend Joan loved. She always loved it. She heard it after 9/11. She had been in New York City because she worked for a law firm that had an office there, and they lost many people. And sometime after, a couple of months after that that event, she had been down there to help set up the new office and just happened upon a concert where Bon Jovi did a version of this live. He just happened to be there. She happened to be there. And she was telling me about it and how much this meant to me. At the service, the friend of the family who was presiding over this was also a minister. He introduced the song and talked about Leonard Cohen's lyrics, how there's a lot of connections. He has a lot of symbolism and so on that refers to the music the human experience. And I think that had something to do with it, too, that particular song. And to this day, when I sing it, it still has that imagery that it seems so close to the heart and so close to our friend, too.
What about your songs? You've written a song, yeah, and you're working on a second song.
Yeah. So Watkins and the Rapiers, very clever guys. And like I said, they asked me to join them for the December concerts. So, I get to see, they must have over 100 songs that relate to Christmas, and most of them are all satires and parodies and so on. And so I thought, I would love to do something along those lines. And so I was, I came up with a theme, a very simple theme of trying to untangle Christmas lights, the long strings, because I do that every year. I'm in charge of putting up the tree and the lights, and then they tell me to get away. They'll do the ornaments. So so I started coming up with an idea like that. And then I was trying to think of a format for the song. They had waltzes, they had, rock and blues and shuffles and so on, but there wasn't a tango. So that became my idea. I had come up with a song called Christmas Lights Untango. And and I quote a couple of, Blue Tango by Leroy Anderson, and there's also the Jealousy Tango is in there. So it all fit together. It was, there are a lot of sections to it. It took a long time to get it working, and I apologize many times to them. The song is not your typical 1-4-5 chord, but it goes over pretty well. I was at someone's house recently just for a jam, and there was someone who came up to me, pointed at me, and said, "Christmas Lights on Tango." So that's how I'm known now. But yeah, so I've got another one I'm working on, and I'm looking at the calendar, and it's like I've got maybe 2 more weeks to get this together, because in November we'll start practicing for those December shows at the Little.
So what's a typical week like for you? How many nights are you playing out?
Yeah, so orchestra's Tuesday night. Another group I play in is called the Geezers. They're coming over today at 1 o'clock. I'm the youngest member, by the way. So we'll get together for that. And then Friday or Thursday nights, we used to play Irish music at a place in Fairport. Unfortunately, my two favorite musicians, Marlene and Brendan, Marlene's a fiddler and Brendan plays boron, are also both surgeons, and they just moved to Philadelphia. They got new jobs. She's done. She's a vascular surgeon who just finished at Strong. So we're in the process of working in a new fiddle player and so on. That's going to happen in a couple of weeks. So there's time I play by myself, either working out some new songs or learning some new songs.
It sounds like music has been a vehicle for you to meet a lot of really interesting people.
Yes. Okay. So here my connections are these. When I retired in 2007, I really didn't retire. I went on to teach for 3.5 more years in my same job. But at that time, my daughter got a Doberman puppy, and we all raised it, my daughter, my wife, myself. And when I started walking Porter, we went down to Mount Hope Cemetery, where there were just a lot of hills and great places to visit. And it's at that point where I met a whole bunch of other dog people. I knew the names of their dogs before I knew them, their names. but one of the people I met was Adam Wilcox with his dog Violet, which is a...
it's a beautiful dog. What is it?
It's a Portuguese water dog. Actually, it's a... Isn't this awful?
I know. Adam's going to kill us. It's a gorgeous dog.
Yeah, it's a mountain dog.
Bernese
mountain dog. And I was talking to someone about this earlier. I just went blank. But I start, Violet and Porter are playing and so on. And Adam and I get talking, and he says, "I'm a bass player," and I said, "Well, I'm a bass player too. I don't play enough bass. I wish I played more, but every band I'm in, it's always someone else is playing bass." So we get talking, and somehow we get together, and he said, you know, I'd like you to play with me. I'm playing at the Unitarian Church with this Megan and other people, and can you join us? And sure. So I play with them, and out of that comes Megan Koch and the Gentlemen Callers. Another member of that band is Jeff Love, and all of a sudden now Jeff and I get together, and he invites me to play with the Geezers. So I think of all the connections, all the groups I'm playing in now, all just because of walking a dog.
So you have this really interesting overview then of Rochester's music scene, from your work in the orchestra to, you know, playing out in bands. You know, how would you describe Rochester's music scene?
It is very vibrant. It's very widespread. Of course, with Eastman here, when my kids were little, I would, you know, put them to bed, and I could be at Eastman Theater or Kilburn in 8 minutes. So I would just take in every concert I could. And I think with all the music here from Eastman and the students, there's just such a scene. There's such variety. And I think that this town is kind of unique in a way, too, because there's enough music to go around. I imagine, you know, New York City, some larger cities, it would be really tough to be able to play out somewhere. Where here, it's very easy. There are many venues and just so many unique people out there who are like magnets for other groups and new members and so on.
Do you think there's a larger concentration of people that make music in Rochester?
I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's a great opportunity. There are many music makers, but there's a great opportunity to actually do it. Yeah.
Now, what happened to you in Ireland?
Oh, Ireland was wonderful. We were there for 2 weeks, and got to hear traditional Irish music just about everywhere we went. In Dingle and Doolin, there are just many, many pubs with live music, and heard some wonderful players. One thing we were able to do is go to Christy Barry's house in Doolin, where it's basically a house concert, but he takes the time to talk about the music of Doolin, how it began, how the laborers, people who worked, you know, all day would come together at night and play their music as part of a social experience. They'd go into the bar to talk about their day, catch up, gossip, tell a joke, but also play the music. He also talked about how the music in Doolin was different from the music down the road, and how when people would travel, they'd bring some different tunes here and there. So it's very, again, a very basic human behavior to play music as well as socialize.
And you heard a whistler there.
Yes, a wonderful whistler. Yes, yes, Christy Barry. And he's actually got there are two jigs, Christy Barry's number one and number two, that he composed, and they're known all around the world. And it was funny, Brenda, after he got done playing that Christy Barry's one and two, he said, any questions? And I said, yeah. So I don't know if people here, the 18 people in the room, I don't know if you know, but that is called Christy Barry's number one and two around the world. And he responded, he said, well, yeah. He was very humble about it. And I said, well, how does that feel to you, someone who's got a jig set named after you, and alongside all these songs that are hundreds of years old? And he looked at me and said, well, I'm not 100 yet.
Well, Pete, you have been wonderful. Is there something that I haven't asked you about the power of music or your experience, you know, speaking that mystical language, you know, the contact you've had over the years that I haven't asked you about yet?
You know, it's just incredible how diverse music can be across so many different cultures, how we can all get together and play together or sing together, listen together, and enjoy the music together.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored.